And we're excited about having Michigan on board because they've had these amazing relationships in place. And the first year of the grant, I went around to states to find out, I've called it their gems. What are they doing really, really well? I was blown away by Shannon and her team and how well they have what great relationships they have with medical examiners and the community. And it was like standing room only at the review I observed in Detroit. It was amazing. There were medical students like climbing to get in the room because they wanted to participate. And the effort it takes to not just develop those relationships, but to maintain those relationships. I wish we could just can it and send it out on the road, Shannon. But it's my pleasure to introduce Shannon Stoltenberg-Wing. She has worked in the area of child welfare, human services for the last 15 years. Shannon's focus has been in the area of infant child death surveillance and prevention as the director of the Michigan Child Death Review at the Michigan Public Health Institute. Shannon holds a Bachelor's of Science degree from Ferris State University, Master's degree in Clinical Social Work with a specialty in child welfare from Michigan State University. Shannon.
Thank you. Well, I think that it's really worth saying, too, when we talk about this, the issue of relationship building and infrastructure, and we really depend on one another as states. I mean, certainly we get a lot of guidance from Lena and Terry, and I took over for Terry when she sort of took her work nationally. So the framework was already there, and the work that she already sort of set a foundation for me, so I was able just to kind of pick it up and run with it. But we really depend on the states, and I think the CDC has developed such an amazing relationship with all of us as well, that I can take some of the work that Lisa is doing and kind of parlay that into the work that we're doing in Michigan. I'm going to talk more to kind of your point on looking at, you know, who is this really affecting? And we'll talk a little bit more about kind of what that looks like. So our process, Lena really wanted me to focus on how do we know? How do we know and get notified of these SUID cases? We use the Department of Human Services, our child protection agency, we have what's called the death alert. And we are one of, one of the only states that have this. When the Child Protective Services Agency is notified of a child death, there are 5 people in the state that get a notification that says this child died. I'm going to show you what one of those looks like later on, but it's an opportunity for us to close that gap. So if I see a death alert, or I don't, we're at a child death review meeting, and I say, we have this death, I never got a death alert on that child, then I can call the Department of Human Services, and that kind of closes that gap. Unlike Lisa's state, her only having 9% of her babies that die having prior child abuse and neglect history, we have far more than that. In our most populous areas, like in Detroit, we have over 80% of our babies that die come from a family that have had prior CPS contact. So in a lot of the issue is, and I've talked to Lena about this in the past, when you look at the data and you look at these infants and you check the box, did they have prior CPS history? Many of these babies are less than 4 weeks old. Many of these babies are less than 6 months old. When we track those babies as a victim, you don't see the numbers. But when you look at the familial structure and you look at the trend pattern and you look at the caregivers, that's when we start to see these really high numbers, especially in places that are economically challenged, that have poverty-stricken issues, and chronic issues, generational chronic child abuse. We really see some of these kind of trends taking place. We also look at case identification through death certificates and our local medical examiners. Michigan is a medical examiner state, but we are not a statewide medical examiner system, which means that the local county boards, the Board of Commissioners, appoint the local medical examiner, there's nobody at the state level that can say, medical examiner in this county, you are terrible, stop calling everything SIDS, and this is what you need to do differently. What we really run into is this idea that if you look, you take 2 cases and they're exactly the same in contiguous counties, and in one county it will be called the SIDS, and in another county it will be called positional asphyxia, which is our ASSB. In Michigan, we've really not made that leap from to ASSB. All of those cases are called positional asphyxial cases. We really have made contacts and continued relationships with our local MEs to really get them involved in this process and know that until, and make it a priority that until they get the death scene investigation and the doll reenactment, that they shouldn't be calling these cases anything until they have the full picture. That really looking at, and I always liken this when I talk to, when I train law enforcement, that if I drop dead right here and Lena says, you know what, I think by looking at her, I think she's got pneumonia, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Are you guys going to be like, oh, we're going to take Lena's word for it? Or are you going to want to know what I died from? Because that certainly would have impact on maybe you running out and figuring out, like, that you're making sure you're not going to die from whatever I drop dead from. But I think it's really, it's we say that in jest, but I think it's really important that that's what's happening. When you look at a case and you respond to a scene and someone said, looks like a SID, before they know anything, we're really doing our families a disservice. And one thing in Michigan that we try to do is we always say to families, we want your baby's story to be told. And I think that really takes a strong local team. It takes a strong local professionals to really make that connection. We look at the SUID process at the case review level from our local teams. We are in every county in Michigan. We have 77 teams that make up all of our 83 counties. Obviously, in the UP, some of those teams are 4 and 5 counties wide, just because just from our office in mid-Michigan, it can take 13 hours to get to one of the local teams. And my staff of 4, for all of child death review, we attend more than 90% of the meetings and we act as consultants and technical assistance advisors. But for the SUID grant, we have one FTE that's made up of lots of different people. But it's sorely, I think we could do a lot more work with the prevention side as we move forward with the resources, but that's one of the things that we're going to continue to work on. Case entry, a lot of what Terry talked about, the richness in the data and getting the information is dependent on who puts the information in. And for those of you that saw that sheet of paper, that packet of information, the 16 pages of data elements that we collect, we have local volunteers that put that information in. Coordinators that just are overworked and under-resourced, but they know that there's really benefit to knowing what's going on in their community. So when I talked about the death alert, this is kind of what I get. And I don't know what happened. The first page is missing, but it will give you the demographic information. It talks about any other Department of Human Services in programs involved. We want to know if there's an open CPS case at the time of death. We want to know if this is a foster child. There in Michigan, we have certain laws that say we have to review every single foster care death, regardless of the cause and manner. So especially in these baby deaths, it's really important for us. And really looking at, is there a guardianship case? Is it a licensing issue? Is it a child care provider? Those are ways that we're able to take a look at trend patterns. Supervision of the children. Extenuating circumstances, was the person in charge preoccupied, distracted, or asleep at the time of the injury? Our Department of Human Services now understands the idea of that safe sleep is an injury-driven issue, that we've got to kind of shift that focus from this natural syndrome that happens to some babies to really looking at the fact that this is an external injury, death in many of these cases, and really do some of these issues play into that? Did the mom smoke? Did she smoke during her pregnancy? Was the infant breastfed? Was the child in a safe sleep environment? I'll tell you, one of the big struggles is we have a centralized intake. In Michigan, we just went to centralized intake for Child Protective Services in March of this year. Prior to that, it was county-driven. So counties would assign some stuff, they would not assign some other stuff. Well, now it's a centralized intake to sort of shore up the consistency. But with that is people putting in the information. They might not know that the baby is in a safe sleep environment. How do you know when somebody calls in and say, hey, I have a baby that was brought into the hospital this morning unresponsive? But they're checking the box. Again, they're saying, oh, that baby looks like a SIDS. Well, we don't really know. And so I've been really working with the department to make sure a lot of folks use this information as gospel. And we really need to do a better job at collecting accurate information. We get a circumstances text box as well as the Child Protective Services history. This really gives us this idea of trending families. Certainly not for punitive measures always, but looking at families where they are. And Lisa does such an amazing job of that in New Jersey, and we're going to be learning from a lot of her work. We too have issues in Michigan with this idea. You know, we have lots of transient populations, especially in our urban areas. And we were really hit hard by the big three collapse a few years ago. And so we just have people moving constantly. The foreclosure rates in Michigan are through the roof. And people cannot, they just don't have cribs. And if they do, they don't know how to put them together. I have a master's degree, and I couldn't put a crib together if my life depended on it. But and some of those pack and plays are real hard to put together, too. But those are something that's much easier and much more mobile when families move from house to house or apartment to apartment. The state of Michigan, however, says that the child care licensing and the foster care licensing folks, you may not get licensed to be a foster parent of a child under one unless you have a wood crib. And we said, whoa, time out. Why would we be putting sort of those kind of constraints on something like that? And a lot of what they talked about is this idea of the baby feeling that they have a safe, non-movable bed. And I say, the baby doesn't know that bed moves, that you can move it from one room to the other. So really looking at, you have to change this mindset. And this idea that if a family moves, I'd rather have a foster family that's going to take in a baby that doesn't have anywhere else to go with a pack and play than to really think about the fact that we can't license somebody because they only have a wood crib. So we're really looking at some of these ideas, and the SUD case registry has allowed us to look more in that and give data on how many babies are dying in these unsafe sleep environments, and how that kind of resonates with the work that they're doing. So we talked a lot about data cleaning and what we're doing with the data. We clean 100% of our cases. 3 years ago when we applied for the first grant, we said we were going to do quality checks on 10%, and that was going to give us an accurate picture of our case information to make sure it was accurate. Well, what we found is you have to clean every single case. So we sat down as a staff and said, if we're really going to do this right, we need to review every single case as a staff, as my staff person that does this work, and we need to make sure we're requesting the case information, the autopsy for every single baby. We can't really depend on folks putting this information in if we want to give Lena and the CDC the information they need to help pursue this prevention resource. Because I think that's what we hope, all of us in the states. We hope that someday the CDC is going to go, because of all this work that you're doing, we want to give you $1 million to work on prevention. And that's $1 million per state.
Okay.
I just want to make that clear. Really looking at this idea of data-driven, value added, kind of what are we doing? Does it work? Is it something that is meets people where they are, and really looking at these issues. We also get birth records now. We have relationships with the folks at our Vital Stats office at the Department of Community Health, and we get birth records on all this, so we can really look at, are they preemies? Are they, what was their birth weight? Are they low birth rate? Were they low birth rate? Birth weight? So really looking at some of those issues from our non-traditional partners. One of the things that we're working on is the issue of getting information on our death certificates. We are really woefully out of time in our death certificate. We are not an electronic death record state.
Can you hear me through this?
Oh my! Yeah, that we can.
Yeah, we can.
So I pay a woman part-time 2 days a week, and she goes to the Vital Stats Department and picks up a microfiche, and then she goes to the public library, and she looks in the microfiche and pulls out, it has to look at the date, and anybody under 0 to 18, she pulls that for that month, copies it onto a Word document, and then comes back to the office and sorts them from there. Talk about archaic. But that's what we have to work with right now, and so we figure out, you know, what we do for the workaround. And also Department of Human Services, we don't get electronic access to the records. We are really jealous of those states that have the centralized medical examiner's office, they have vital stats, electronic data, and then they can sit in another area, they can go onto their Child Protective Services log and they can see everything. We're like, well, that would be incredible. We don't have that, and that's something that we're working towards, and we're really trying to make sure that we're getting this information when we need it. So our numbers, I don't know why. This might have been the slide that was, there were some issues with it, but we, in 2010, we had 139 sleep-related deaths in Michigan, and unfortunately, I'm sad to report, in 2011, we went up to 141. And for 2012, we're pacing 150 this year. So even though we're doing this work and we're getting all the information from a perspective of somebody doing this work, it's really it will take the wind out of your sails very quickly, because it's one of those things where you see it, no matter what we're doing, why are we not getting the message across? And we're hoping that putting this information in can help drive some of that information. Here are the cases based on how old the babies are. As you can see, obviously, it's not a big newsflash that most of our babies are that really high-risk period, are 0 to 4 months. But we can use this with some of those non-traditional partners that don't have an understanding about the differences between SUID and SIDS, and this idea that SIDS isn't just this mysterious thing that may or may not happen to a baby under one, but really look at guiding some of the information. Here is by race, and this is certainly that our African-American babies die in Michigan 4 times the rate of our white babies. Governor Rick Snyder in Michigan this year had two dashboard items for Michigan's sort of health and well-being. One was obesity and one was infant mortality. And, of course, I'm not shy, and I have stood up in all kinds of meetings and said, you know, if we just put some resources into just our sleep-related deaths alone, we would move the needle on our infant mortality rate at least 1 point, and we would just be middle of the road in this country. But instead, we put money into things that, to me, don't move that needle. But I think that safe sleep issues and really looking at what people do in their homes is difficult for politicians to sort of say, I am not jumping on board with telling somebody what they can and can't do in their home. And we're really working on trying to figure out how we deal with that. But as you can see, we really are working, looking at our population-based data to help drive some of our prevention activities. This is a slide that for a lot of folks has been what they really opened people's eyes that, yes, babies die, all babies die from sleep-related, could die from sleep-related issues. But our Medicaid population, even in Michigan, really is, that's our focus. That is almost 70% of our babies are dying in Michigan, and they are Medicaid babies. So what we did with that is I went to the WIC office and I said, I need to talk to somebody about safe sleep, because clearly a lot of these families, WIC is the only place that they're going. They're not going to their pediatric well child checks right on, you know, like I do. Like, it's May 19th and I can't get into the doctor. How is my 11-year-old getting in his well child check? You know, they don't think in terms of that, because that's just not their reality. And so we cannot put our reality onto other people. So you know what? Just like New Jersey, I'm going to meet them where they are. So now I'm on the WIC board for the state, and I help them drive some of their policies and practices based on safe sleep, as well as our financial services area in our Department of Human Services. Now, when there is a newborn added to our Medicaid role or to any of our financial assistance roles, it is a policy that the FIS and ES workers, which are our financial workers, have to give them a safe sleep brochure and talk about that. That's new. To me, that was a no-brainer, but it took hours of meetings and hours of, you know, them saying, we already have too much to do and another piece of paper. But what you can resonate that to is it's saving lives. You know, we've got to kind of take a step back and really understand the work that we're doing here. This is my history of maltreatment. Remember I talked to you about this idea of the victim being the child that has died. Many of the cases that you're going to see here are the no's are just that we didn't have anything on that child as a victim, the decedent as a victim. But I will tell you just anecdotally, especially in our more populous areas, again, we are that red line I think should be over here on yes. Because what we're really seeing is this familial cycle of chaos. And we know that where there is chaos, people make decisions that maybe aren't in the best interest of the family, but because that's what they need to do to get through the day. And so I think it's important for us to take a look at this and not only look at it from a chart, but drill it down, because this isn't reflective of the reality of what's going on. And I think sometimes we get really bogged down with, well, what does the data say? And what is it? And data is super, hear me, CDC funder, data is very important. But I really need to make sure that people understand that it's not just about the chart. It's about the reality of what's going on in our areas. This is history of open CPS case. Again, my contention is It needs to go the other way. We have a real issue with drug-positive babies, especially in our urban areas, and we're working with the University of Michigan in their public health epidemiology school to look at if babies that are born drug-positive, especially the THC. I'm Polish and loud. I can talk over any of these people, just so you know. So if it gets louder and I get louder, that's why. But really, we're looking at this idea that babies born THC positive have a higher risk of dying in a sleep-related environment. So if you take a baby that's not born drug positive and you put them in an unsafe sleep environment, and a baby born drug positive THC and you put them, the THC born positive baby are far more likely to die than the non. So we're really looking at driving some of this work as well, which is it's something that we haven't done in the past. This is by manner of death. This is our sleep-related deaths, what we're calling them. Obviously, we still have a pretty big issue with this natural. One of the things that we're working on in the state of Michigan that we want to keep in mind is that bronchopneumonia, a lot of our medical examiners will, if there's a little bit of bronchopneumonia, instead of saying positional asphyxia or undetermined, they're going to say, oh, natural, it was pneumonia. And we really struggle with that a lot because we know that babies that are put in situations like that have these sort of stress, respiratory distress, and that can grow pneumonia, especially if they're kept on artificial respiration. And we're really working with our medical examiners to understand that. In fact, in the city of Detroit, we now, the medical examiners can no longer call anything bronchopneumonia on a baby that has a death scene investigation without it going through the chief medical examiner because of those very same issues. I just got the 5-minute warning sign, so I'll go quickly. This is just by external cause. Asphyxia, obviously, is our highest. This is by medical cause. Again, we still have the issue with SIDS. We're working on that. But we have a few medical examiners in a few counties that will call everything SIDS no matter what. And so that really skews our numbers. This is by death scene. We're doing a great job in Michigan making sure that our cases are, and my staff do training all the time on for our death scene investigators. These are what the medical examiner gets before making their cause and manner determination. I know we had a question about, well, what is the sort of driving force when a medical examiner says it's going to be positional asphyxia or ASSB as opposed to undetermined? All this information, scene photos, DAW reenactment, law enforcement, making sure that they're at the scene, witness interviews. This is by sleep place. Obviously, by far, being in an adult bed is much more. The other, that's the bouncy seat. People love to put their babies in the swings and bouncy seats to sleep, and that can be compromising just in the natural position that it goes in. This is by position. On its back, a lot of folks will say, oh, well, you said put it on its back. Well, but they're on its back in a bed, on a couch, in other unsafe sleep environments. This is with sleeping with a person and or animal. Obviously, that's another huge risk factor. And for our lessons learned, a lot of this is, we used to give our investigators a cheat sheet and say, if you just fill out all this and check the box, then everything's going to be great. Well, what we found out is they don't want to do that, and they won't do that, and I can get a better death scene investigation if I don't give them something else to check. And really, electronic access, like I told you, it's a hindrance to us, and it's become something that it's draining our resources. So when I call Lena and beg for more money, a lot of it is because, not that would be alleviated if we had the electronic access, but certainly having to pick up the phone and call constantly and send things and try to figure this stuff out, it can be pretty daunting. We are, like Lisa, doing a statewide PSA. We're interviewing parents. We're interviewing parents that have lost a child, and we're doing a statewide PSA that's likened to the Baltimore the Be More Healthy Babies video. And you can go on YouTube, and you can see that. It's called Be More Healthy Babies. And it's incredible. And it's actual parents telling their story and people saying, if I just would have listened. I knew what everybody said, but I thought I was going to be the exception. When you hear that from someone who has suffered a loss, I think that's really that really helps resonate. So in the next 3 years, we're just going to basically keep on keeping on in Michigan. So I appreciate your time, and I'm really thankful to be here today. Thank you.